Tommy smirked. I'll retreat to my bomb shelter. He raised the gun once more and knocked off the next bottle. So I assume you didn't swing by for parental advice or whatever the hell you'd call it.
No.
Drove down from L.A.?
Private jet.
Whose?
Cartel guy.
Oh, Tommy said.
Mission?
To knock off a different cartel guy. You are one complicated former whatever the fuck.
I contain multitudes.
What's the drill?
Gear for an exfil. I'm undercover. With the different cartel guy.
Which cartel?
Leones.
Undercover in the Leones? Tommy whistled. Could you be more eager to punch yourself in the dick?
After this mission, I'm swearing off self-dick-punching.
Tell me some about this Mongolian cluster fornication you've got yourself up into.
Evan sketched the details of the mission, leaving out particulars. When he finished, Tommy scowled, mustache bristling.
I hate those cartel sadists with their thug armies and private castles. All flash and bling and cry-bully cruelty. Uday Hussein gold-plated toilets, holding their chrome-plated guns sideways like kids in one of them rap videos.
A rap video, huh?
You know what I mean.
So yeah,
I'll help you give that motherfucker a habanero enema.
That's touching in a racist kind of way.
What do you need?
Tunnel security. The good shit.
Tommy looked offended. I only deal in the good shit. This looked like a Radio Shack.
No. It looks like a junkyard for disused Radio Shack gear.
Well, hell. You want a pretty face? Talk to an L.A. waiter.
Tommy aimed and squeezed, and another Jack Daniels bit the dust. An alertness had returned to his hound dog eyes. Over the years, Evan had learned that no matter how much Tommy drank, he was always one serious conversation away from sober.
Now, Tommy said, I got me some micro-surveillance tech out of Haifa. Waterproof, high res, impossible to spot, lens the size of the head of a pin. Hide him in a real pebble, hollowed out. Sales guy paraded out a sample at SHOT Show, buried one in a real quarter, sliced in half and put back together. The camera was George Washington's eye. Dude was so excited to show it off, he should have been tripod-mounted.
Vivid imagery.
We aim to please. I also got fusion sensors with traditional IR night vision and thermal, both technologies in the same tube. Cool thing about those puppies is they can scan a pitch-black area with zero ambient IR, let you see inside the devil's asshole. Small, too. 4 inches by 1.5 inches.
Weight?
Real light. About the same as 1.5 loaded 1911 magazines.
Tommy measured most items in munition units.
Okay. But all that stuff?
It's a ploy. For what I really need to smuggle in.
Which is?
Evan pulled a crumpled cocktail napkin from a cargo pocket. On the flight in, he'd jotted down his wish list and then taken a quick nap. I need these delivered in a utility van to this address. Evan tapped the napkin, where he'd written the location of the Hertz rental lot in Guadiridon. Stored beneath a false bottom in the cargo hold, all the tunnel tech goes above on full display. They're just props. Tommy reviewed the list of weaponry, tugging at his mustache, a devious smile edging his lips.
Now you're lighting candles in my church.
Van's gotta be lifted, but not so much to be noticeable. Oversized tires will be less obvious than giant shock absorbers.
When do you need to get your dick skinners on all this gear?
Tomorrow noon. Tommy laughed. He finger-scooped the wedge of tobacco from his lower lip and flung it into the dirt.
That's a hard no fucking way. I can't lasso all that gear, custom up the van and have it waiting in the dead center of Cartelsville and...
He shot his wrist clear of a non-existent cuff, glanced at a non-existent watch.
30 hours?
I'll give you until end of day.
Another 5 whole hours? You're the picture of charity.
Tommy cocked his head, chewed a lip, considering. Friday, 5 o'clock, Guaridon. That's a big ask on top of a big ask. How are you going to pay for it?
I'm not. Evan nodded at the two carry-ons. He is.
Tommy sucked down another half-inch of cigarette and flicked it into the sand.
Making a man pay for his own execution.
Tell you what, I'll make that cargo van black. Match the color of your heart.
Thanks, Tommy.
Hell, there's a pregnant broad riding on it. Who am I to stand in the way of your redemption story?
Evan let that one go.
Can you trust him? Tommy asked.
Her old man. The first cartel guy.
Not really a cartel guy, Evan said. More like an unconventional businessman.
Well, doesn't that sound like a load of shit?
Tommy shrugged.
Answers the question, though.
He's not all the way right, Evan said, but he's right in the right ways.
Tommy nodded soberly.
Ain't that all of us? Tuned to different frequencies. This one's gotta have 2.3 drinks a night to get right, and that one's gonna heist an armored car because he needs to learn or die from the punishment. He works 120 hours a week on the stock exchange. She takes meds, pumps out crumb snatchers, and waits for that 5 o'clock Chardonnay. Whether we shoot up or fuck up, we're all in the same bathtub. But it's nice now and again when you find someone hums the same tune as you and rows the same direction.
He hoisted the bottle and tipped it to Evan in a toast.
That's the only shelter in this wondrous, nasty world. The only thing that matters. Everything else is just wainscoting.
Evan made a noise of affirmation in his throat. Tommy offered him the gun.
Want to take a shot?
I'm good.
Look at that. There. See that sun coming up?
Is there anything makes your heart ache more than a desert sunrise?
Evan took in the sight. Glorious purples and oranges shaded with pastels. The kinds of hues he forgot nature could make, until he remembered that nature made everything. It called to mind Peter's crayon colors, atomic tangerine and wild blue wonder, all the everything. Which led to thoughts of Mia and her neurosurgery consult mere hours away. Another outcome that could turn a family's world upside down in a hot second. So much beauty out there. And so much pain. The two men soaked it in, each with his private thoughts.
Man, Tommy said, what I'd give to be sitting here with a chunky, round-faced brunette with bangs right now instead of your skinny ass.
Skinny? And here I've been doing power squats and everything.
Tommy admired the slender barrel of the pistol, that cerebellum bulge of the recoil spring housing.
Know what sin means? I mean, the root or etymology or whatever the fuck?
Evan thought back to his lessons with Jack in the study, flickering orange light from the fireplace, smell of peat wafting off Jack's old-fashioned glass.
It's Greek, isn't it?
Hamartia.
That's the one.
From Hamartano. Now, why would a knuckle-dragger like me know a $10 word like that?
Because it's an archery term.
That's right.
Tommy smiled big.
Means to miss the mark. That's what we do when we sin. We miss the mark. And I've been thinking out here alone these past few nights. Just me and the mosquitoes. Then maybe that's why I do what I do all these years. Why I became a marksman. To aim right. Aim true. And maybe that's why you do what you do. These bleeding heart missions of yours. Trying to hit the mark. Trying to get one goddamn thing right for once. It may all be foobarred out there. But a bullet flies straight if you treat it right. And with all the mess and mayhem in this goddamn world, even you, Orphan X, can fly straight once in a blood moon.
It was the first time Tommy had ever used Evan's code name. They'd always dodged direct questions about their respective pasts, Tommy allowing Evan the fiction that he didn't know, really know, who he was. But something about the early morning light and the sour mash allowed a loosening of the screws, a sense that what was spoken here, in the pale blue glow of real Vegas, would stay in Vegas. Tommy brought the Borchardt up and squeezed off three quick shots, all of them bullseyes. He eyed the last bottle standing, then let his gaze lift to the horizon. Then he tapped the barrel against Evan's forearm. "When's the last time you held history in your hands? Come on, give it a go." Evan took the Borchardt C-93 and lined the iron sights at the lonely bottle of Jack. He eased out an exhale, waited for the space between heartbeats, fired, and missed. Tommy took another glug from the bottle, patted Evan's knee. "Maybe next time, instead of power squats, young Padawan, you should get your damn eyes checked." Chapter 49. Blech. Evan sat on the floor with his back to door 12B of Castle Heights. He didn't know how long a neurosurgeon's consultation should take, but Mia's appointment was at 10 and it was already past 1 o'clock. A long time in a neurosurgeon's office didn't make for optimism. He was drifting off when the elevator dinged and a cacophony of voices spilled out. Here came the family, lumbering toward him, Mia's face tight and stoic, Peter glazed, Wally red-eyed from crying, and Janet looking meek and defeated. Evan popped to his feet as they descended on him. Mia moved past him, fumbled her keys into the deadbolt. "I thought you were out of the country." She scarcely looked at him, but he could tell she wasn't upset with him. She was barely holding it together. "I'm back." The door opened, and Peter bounded into his room and slammed the door behind him. They'd all sort of tumbled into the condo, and the adults now stood awkwardly around the wooden kitchen table, Mia leaning on a chair back as if for support, arms locked. Wally and Janet looked stricken. Janet said, "It'll all be okay, Mia. Janet? No. Okay, just... no." Mia was shaking her head. Wally scratched his nose, looking down. We should give you and Peter some space. Rest up and, His voice was wavering. "Is there anything we can do?" Janet pleaded. "Give us something to do." "You don't need to do anything, sweetie," Mia said. Janet's lips were trembling. "Just, please, tell me something to do." "Okay," Mia said. "After the surgery, everyone from the office is going to be overly helpful and bring too much food by. And I don't want Peter eating a bunch of frozen casseroles." She emphasized the noun like it was a curse word. "Okay. I want him to eat healthy. And not all leftovers, you know. When Roger and I got married, we drove to Niagara Falls for a kind of ironic throwback honeymoon, and his mom sent us off with a honey-baked ham. I've always thought that's the definition of eternity. Two people and a ham. So if you can make sure he's eating well, that will give me one less thing to worry about. Okay?" Janet bunched a fist over her mouth, nodded rapidly. Wally looked on the verge of collapse. "I really think we should give you some space, sis." "Okay, Wally. I'd like that." They embraced, and Wally sobbed into her shoulder a minute and said, "Sorry. It's okay."
"Sorry."
"It's okay."
"Sorry."
"Enough." Mia pulled back and managed a tremulous smile, and then Wally and Janet were gone, and it was just Evan and Mia in the sudden silence of the condo. Emotions were still swirling in the air, tangible enough to grab. Grief and fear, thick like a scent. Evan did what he often did, throwing up a filter, compressing the situation into boundaries that could be contended with, a set of challenges to be confronted. He needed facts and figures, and from them he would determine a battle plan. He said, "I'm going to assume the news wasn't good." "That is a fair assessment." Mia took a breath, held it, big exhale that puffed out her cheeks. "Could be worse, though," Evan said. "Diagnosis?" "Cavernous hemangioma. A bleed. It's not so much what it is as where it is. Dead center of the corpus callosum, millimeters from the fornices, which is the memory center." She seemed relieved to be talking facts. Evan knew it, too. The comfort of hard numbers, of staring a threat in the teeth unblinkingly. "Requires a craniotomy," she said. "Cut a hatch in the skull and drill right down through my brain."
"Prognosis?"
15% or so I die on the table. 30, I suffer permanent short-term memory loss. Like, in 2 years I'll wake up every morning and still think Peter's 9. And in 10 years, and 20, maybe even every hour, every 15 minutes, I'll have to rediscover his real age and then figure out how to catch up to it. Not to mention what he'll have to figure out. So I'd prefer the 15% to the 30, actually. But I don't get to choose. Her eyebrows hoisted. A there you have it punctuation. So yeah, it sucks. Like ham and casserole. A hint of a smile. Like ham and casserole.
Date?
Monday. My mom had heart stuff, so I take a baby aspirin a day. I stopped today because anticoagulant. They can't wait for it to clear my bloodstream entirely. Too pressing, but wanted to give it at least 4 days. Assuming I don't get all gorked out by then.
Are you...
What? She bit her lower lip, rolled it between her teeth. I don't know if you're out of the country again. I think it might be good for Peter if... Shit, I don't know.
I will try to be back.
You'll try to be back?
Yes.
What you're into... It's life or death.
It is.
Right. Right. It always is.
But so is this.
Yes, she said. So is this.
She kept her hands clenched on the chair back, the table between them, like she was walling herself off from him, the world. A tilt of her chin toward Peter's closed door.
Would you like to see him?
He had to be back in Guaridon, but it was clear she needed him here. What was more important? A pregnant young woman in the hands of the Leones? Or a terrified single mother and her 9-year-old boy? This was the kind of math he did not do. How was he supposed to balance these scales? He reached for the 7th commandment for guidance. One mission at a time. Evan said,
No.
She stared at him.
Okay.
She started to say something else, hesitated, caught herself.
There was a fragility in the air between them, as if they were both aware that they were embarking on the type of conversation that was outside the purview of their relationship, and that they'd have to tread lightly in case they broke something that couldn't be put back together.
Here we go. Mia took a deep breath. All the things I like you for aren't the things you think I like you for.
My matinee idol looks?
Another near smile.
No, and not your 2% body fat, which is nice sometimes, but mostly annoying. Like, eat a cheeseburger.
The thing is, I know what you're made of. I know what you're capable of. I've caught a glimpse of it. But you have no idea what I'm capable of.
And I am going to get through this alive. For Peter. I believe you. But all my rah-rah, go me, I'm gonna beat this thing energy. I can't afford to indulge it when it comes to Peter. So I have to steel myself to make sure I get through while making plans for that little boy. The first quiver in her voice. In the event that I don't. Do you understand? Perfectly. Right. You're good at this, because it involves danger and menace. Yes, he said. I am. Wally and Janet get custody of Peter if, you know. You've met my brother. He has a great heart, and I love him to the bone. But he's a dipshit. Dipshit might be harsh. Dipshit is charitable. And I'm worried Wally might not have everything Peter needs. I have money, Evan said. I will make sure Peter never ends up in a foster home. The words came out in a burst, with an intensity he scarcely recognized as something he possessed. Mia was staring at him, surprised and, it seemed, moved. She knew nothing of his past, and he realized he'd just opened a window into the core of himself. I have money, Evan, she said gently. It's not about money. Okay. He was trying to recover, backpedaling within himself. What's it about, then? You're a... a gentleman. And there aren't a lot of places young boys can look and see gentlemen these days. I'm not a gentleman. You prove my point. And I'd like you to be there for Peter. Emotionally. The sound went out. For a moment, Evan only heard white noise and the thump, thump, thump of his heart. He knew that words were required, but they were out of reach. He had no idea what he was feeling or how to direct those sensations into sentences. Mia watched him with patience, and what looked like kindness. You have to raise a kid to have trust that the world will treat him fairly, she said. Then maybe he'll have enough trust to get through when it doesn't. And I don't want... She tilted her head back, eyes pulling to the ceiling, holding the brimming tears in. I don't want him to ever need comfort and not find it. That's not what I do, Evan said. What? Comfort. You do. More than you think. This is too big a responsibility for you to risk being wrong. I'm taking that risk, she said. I'm playing the odds as is, letting them, you know, cut my head open. If I promise to do something, he said, I do it every time. I don't know that I can do this, so I can't promise it. I'm not asking for a promise. I'm laying my potentially last wish on you and leaving it up to your sense of duty, which means you at least have to try. How does someone try something like that? She thought about it. A lot of people have good intentions, but the wrong words. And you can fight them on the wrong words all day without seeing through to their intentions. Like you. If I just paid attention to your words, I never would have let you into my bedroom. And my... Shit. I guess my heart. Ugh. She stuck out her tongue. I'm shockingly not good at this. Another breath. But what I mean is, with kids, with Peter, he has the wrong words sometimes. What he says he needs, what he thinks he wants. You have to see beneath that, to what his intentions are. Because that boy, another quiver. He's got the purest intentions of anyone I know. Evan nodded. She said, and And?
When there's a kid around, you have to try to be the best version of yourself. Me. But you too, now.
Of myself?
Yes.
Like, you suck at asking for help. I can't be mad at you for that. But I sure want to be sometimes.
And I don't want Peter to grow up like that, not asking for help. Don't put that on him. He's a boy. He'll get that enough. I want him to be healthier.
She wasn't crying, but there was a deep sadness in her words, and great respect for Evan as well in her stating boldly what needed to be boldly stated.
I want him to be better than you.
Evan said, me too. She nodded.
Don't hug me, please.
A hug would wreck me right now. She glanced to Peter's closed bedroom door.
I need to go talk with him. And then just be with him. As much as I can.
I understand. Evan started out, hesitated, looked back at her. I'll do everything I can to be here for your surgery. She summoned a sad smile that crinkled the edges of her eyes.
Thank you, Mr. Danger.
She started toward Peter's room. Pausing halfway out the front door, Evan watched her walk across the living room. She set her hand on the doorknob, head lowered, paused. 2 seconds. 3. 4. Her hunched shoulders rose as she took a deep breath, settled back lower than they'd been. He watched her enter her son's room, then eased out of her condo. Halfway down the hall, the door to the trash room was ajar. The soporific voice of Hugh Walters echoed inside the walls. Need to ensure that the chute width is up to code, as specified in Section 82 of the NFPA's Waste and Linen Handling Systems. At the sound of the HOA president's voice, Evan clenched his teeth hard enough to engender an ache in his molars. Assessing the open door threat, he made a threshold evaluation, moving to a tactical stride. Light on his original SWAT boots, he hugged the near wall to minimize exposure. He zipped by silently, padding to the elevator, finger extended to punch the up button when, "Mr. Smoke!" Evan stared at the elevator doors. Freedom, mere inches away. He turned to see Hugh striding toward him, clipboard in hand. There was nothing in the world Evan wanted to see less right now than Hugh Walters with a clipboard. Farther down the hall, a repairman stared after Hugh with exhausted dismay before withdrawing his turtle head into the trash room. Hugh closed in on Evan like a self-guided missile.
I'm glad I caught you, Mr. Smoke. I feel that you and I got off on the wrong foot and never really found, well, I suppose the right foot.
I don't actually have any issues I need to.
The thing is, here at Castle Heights, the buck stops with me. When the trash chute is 2 inches too narrow, when there's a cricket infestation in the garage, when there are service animal provisions that must be updated.
About that. I don't really require a...
And, well, this really isn't very kind to say, but sometimes I get quite frustrated with our fellow tenants.
I can't imagine what that's like.
I know I'm considered a bit of a hard ass around these parts,
a self-satisfied chuckle. But every time I'm tempted to judge someone for wanting environmentally friendly coffee filters in the lobby, or asking to replace our perfectly suitable social room chairs, or having goddamned allergies.
Hugh paused, breathing hard, his face shiny, eyes huge behind the Coke bottle lenses. I stop and ask myself, I wonder what they're feeling that I'm not. I wonder what vulnerabilities or worries they're dealing with that I know nothing about.
Hugh tapped the clipboard against his thigh, a show of emotional agitation. He was pushing himself here, getting out of his comfort zone. Evan couldn't help but have a shred of admiration for that.
Hugh continued, and Well, I want to tell you that I've waived the pre-registration requirements for service animals. Because, well, I guess what I'm saying is, I don't know what worries you might have that I don't know about, Mr. Smoke. Evan stared at him, dumbfounded. I appreciate that. Hugh tipped his head in a nod. Evan saw him for the first time as an actual person, rather than a self-created caricature. Hugh had always seemed one of those people who'd decided on a persona early in life and worn it so long and so rigidly that he'd forgotten he was anything else. But now Evan found himself wondering at Hugh's inner life. What did he think about before he fell asleep at night? Did he need his clipboards and regulations the way Evan needed his missions and commandments? Because they gave him a sense of order? Of purpose? I know I'm not as interesting as some of the folks who live here, Hugh said. You probably feel that way too. Evan matched his confiding look. But, well, I'm reliable, Hugh said. And reliability might be considered unsexy out there these days. But when someone is struggling with their allergies or anxiety, when they've lost faith that the rules will hold, that they can count on what to expect from the world, that they'll be dealt a fair hand. I guess what I'm saying is that when they've lost trust, I want to be the one who can restore that for them. He lowered his eyes and nodded a few times, as if only now agreeing with what he'd just said. Do you understand? For the first time, Evan dropped any pretense of his cover. He felt like himself, his true self, answering an honest question with an honest answer. I do. Hugh offered his hand. Evan shook it. Chapter 50. Human Eye Juice. Inside the vault, Evan parked himself behind his sheet metal desk and called up the OLED screens covering the walls. Various windows had been left open, providing a history of Joey's latest searches. Countless crime reports, articles, and internal DEA documents on Raul Montesco. Even more on the tentacles of the Leones operation, and a number of failed inquiries for Jacob Baradon, Evan's biological father. Joey had continued looking into this even after their altercation, despite the fact that he didn't want to pursue finding out more about his father. He took a moment to think beneath her words to her intentions, and was momentarily undone. He called up an encrypted video telephony app that she had installed for him. Her fingerprints were all over his life, and dialed her. After two rings, the screen's wallpapering the front wall rendered her life-size before him. In her pod of a hacking station, camo pants, bare feet up by the keyboard, sleeveless tank top showing off the defined muscles of her arms. No smile. On the circular ledge of the desk encompassing her were various keyboards, a number of speed-hacking cubes, a big gulp, and a half-eaten hot dog with an excess of mustard. She crossed her arms, glared at him. "Hear that?" she said. "What?" "That's the sound of me not talking to you." I apologized. "Yes, you did. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'd like to get back to enjoying what little freedom my overlord allows. Is there a version where we... where we what? I don't know. Talk this out? You? Talk something out emotionally?" She stiffened up and gave him robot arms and robot voice, one of her many preferred means of impersonating him. "Me am Orphan X. Me want to have conversation about feeling states of living organism. But me Cylon programming is not enabled to compute human eye juice." "What's a Cylon?" Robot voice continued. "I lack knowledge of all things pop cultural.
This is another infuriating trait that makes me feel superior to my human counterparts. Josephine?
At the sound of his voice, Dog the dog padded over into Joey's workstation and stuck his snout up into the frame. His big tail was wagging, audibly thwacking the curve of desk behind him. Joey scratched his scruff, her voice softening.
Who's a sweet boy? You want a bite?
She offered him the remaining half of her hot dog, which he scarfed down. You know, Evan said, you don't have to feed him every time you eat. She pinned him with a bruised expression.
See? That's so you.
Not thinking about it from his perspective.
The dog's perspective?
Yes!
Think how friggin' pissed you'd be if someone ate all kinds of food in front of you and you had to eat the same canned crap over and over. Like, you have no opposable thumbs and can't get, like, your own food for yourself because you've been taken out of nature into a world of opposable thumb privilege. And this selfish a-hole buys whatever she wants and opens it up with, like, her superior digits, and it smells all delicious and she can't even spare a scrap.
Oh, and by the way, you bred me to be, like, super loving and loyal. I mean, I'm literally evolutionarily designed to have to be nice to you. Like, it's in my DNA to not kill you and take your food, but hey, tough shit, and just sit there and watch me eat, because screw you, right?
You want to raise a dog with dignity, not just to obey.
See, that's what you still don't get, X.
Sometimes you have to take care of people the way they want to be taken care of.
Dogs.
Huh?
You mean dogs? Sometimes you have to take care of dogs the way they want to be taken care of.
That's what I said.
Click. Once again, he was alone in the vault. But Joey's hostile absence made Alone feel lonelier. Just him and the history of her digital meanderings, including a search for the father he'd never known and didn't care to know. He thought again of his half-brother out there, whom he still hadn't reconnected with since the last mission, and his half-brother's daughter, which would make her Evan's...
what?
His niece? I have a niece, he thought. He'd never met her in person. He had a not-really-significant other heading into a life-threatening surgery. Her 9-year-old son, whom he not-really mentored, Aragon and Belicia Urrea, who were not-really friends, their daughter, not-really a client, and Joey, his not-really-niece person, who was really angry with him. It wasn't hard to see that he was the common denominator of all this. Not really-ness. He looked to the side of his mouse pad where Vera, too, used to sit. Her vacancy was disconcerting. He shoved back from the desk and walked pointedly to the kitchen, doing his best to ignore the Velcro wall and the mirrored globe dangling overhead. He'd deal with them later. No signs of life yet from the living wall, but Vera 3 was there on the island in the glass salad bowl where he'd left her. She lay on her side, roots splayed, bereft of pebbles to take hold of. He straightened her up to restore for her a bit of dignity. Fed her an ice cube. To meet Tommy's shipment, he had to be at the Hertz office in Guaridon by tomorrow at 5 p.m. Aragon's pilot would meet him at the Santa Monica airport at O'Dark 100, which would give him plenty of time to get back to Eden, and from there across the border in the rented Chevrolet Matisse. That gave him one night at home. Instinctively, his gaze moved to the freezer room. Joey'd had the armored sunscreen shades installed, though they were drawn up beneath their inset housing, leaving a breathtaking view of Los Angeles at night. The city lights shone through the armored glass and the panes of the freezer room, silhouetting the bottles of vodka with their sultry curves. But with everything going on here, in Eden, in Guaridon, he had to stay sharp. Back to the master suite, averting his eyes once more so as not to let in the Velcro rise to his side and the disco ball above. Out of his clothes, into the shower.
He used Dr. Bronner's magic soap to scour his body, the peppermint variety that made his skin tingle. Back to the bedroom, into a pair of boxer briefs, up onto the floating mattress. Wait. His bed. He stared down past the edge of the levitating slab of metal at the floor, 3 feet below. Neodymium rare earth magnets and steel cables created a push-pull effect that held his bed suspended in thin air. He'd climbed right onto the hovering unit without noticing that it had been restored. Another task accomplished by Joey in a wholly implausible time frame. Everywhere he looked, it seemed he was being confronted with evidence of her competence and self-sufficiency. But still, an unchaperoned road trip? No way. He had one night to sleep before his return to the baking heat of Guadri Dome, with its caged victims and human-eating lions, and men unshackled from the laws of civilization. In a few hours' time, he'd start his journey into the heart of darkness. Already he'd rehearsed the exfiltration in his mind's eye dozens of times, making adjustments, running iterations, each wrong turn or hesitation leading to a bullet in the head, his skin flayed from his body, the air choked from his lungs in a concrete-filled oil drum. Every last scenario ended in death. His death, Angelina's death, Raimundo's, the unborn babies. Every last scenario. Except one. To pull this off, Evan couldn't merely be excellent. He'd have to be perfect. He had to find the place within himself where he ceased to exist, where he yielded to instinct and muscle memory and neural pathways, where he'd run the mission so many times that it was rote, grounded not in thinking but in habit, where he could slow it down to a snail's pace or manage it on fast forward, where he could conduct it blind or see it through despite a fatal injury. The second commandment, how you do anything is how you do everything. He veiled his eyes, not quite open, not quite closed, until the world turned to a gauzy fog of half-light. It took a solid 10 minutes for him to find his breath properly, to feel where it expanded the floor of his stomach, his ribs, until it rose up to press out the space beneath his clavicles. In the single inhalation filling his body, there were more air molecules than there were grains of sand on every beach on Earth. A miracle and a wonder in every mundane instant. Just a man suspended 21 stories above the ground and 3 feet above that, breathing in until he became the air and the air became him, until he was merely a respiring organism in the whole of the universe, which itself was fire and gas and blackness pricked by points of light, the entire weightless mass expanding and contracting like the walls of his own lungs. He narrowed his focus to the hazy band of the Milky Way, zoomed in on the solar system, flew past the Sun, Mercury, Venus, to the blue mossy ball tinged with white, zeroed in on North America, vectored to the west coast, the hanging chad of California, closed in on the southern half of the state, Los Angeles flying up at him, down into West L.A., the Wilshire Corridor, through the roof of Castle Heights, his penthouse, the walls of the master bedroom, the four corners of his mattress, his body, all of it, the shape and sound and feel of 30 trillion cells, structured and harmonized, breathed into life by the air moving through them. He was here and there. He was omnipresent and impalpable, everywhere and nowhere. The Nowhere Man. And he was ready for the horrors that tomorrow promised to hold. Chapter 51. Professional Courtesy. At 4:57 p.m., Evan picked up the cargo van, black, as promised, from the curb adjacent to Hertz. A homeless guy stinking of tequila lay slumped against the oversized front tire, tattered cowboy hat pulled over his eyes. Evan roused him, a gentle tap of his boot against the guy's sandaled foot. Before the soft kick connected, the guy rolled onto his feet with surprising grace and stared at Evan with clear brown eyes.
"Tommy said to tell you, don't miss the mark," he said, then dropped a single car key into Evan's palm and shuffled away.
Evan climbed into the cargo hold, which was grubby, a few oil spills, grime at the seams, an amoeba of hardened chewing gum on the floor in the corner. He took a moment to change into the clothes he'd requested. They looked like what he'd worn for the bulk of the mission. Facial recognition thwarting pattern on the button-up, tactically discreet cargo pants with streamlined inner pockets. A number of Pelican crates held the surveillance gear he had ordered. But the clothes and the security equipment weren't what mattered. What mattered was what was hidden beneath the false bottom of the cargo hold. 45 minutes later, he pulled beneath the giant carved monkeys of the Grand Archway. The chicken coop looked empty, each cell showing only a band of late-day sunlight near the bars. The invisible inhabitants pulled back into the shade like overheated zoo animals. He double-checked the position of the decoy sewer grates and storm drains along the driveway and gardens, as he had those leading into the estate, then noted the positions of the guards. Sure enough, his favorite sicario was waiting at the portico, arms crossed. Evan edged off the driveway and parked half over a disused flower bed. Rolling down the passenger window, he caught a waft of jasmine and could hear rats scurrying in the gardens, awaiting their next feast.
"The hell kind of parking job is this, Gabacho?"
Darling Boy asked, approaching.
"Lot of valuable gear in here," Evan said, climbing out. "I don't want one of you idiots clipping the van on your way in."
"Don't move."
Darling Boy stopped Evan with a spread hand, spun him around less gently than was warranted, and frisked him from the ankles up, groping at his crotch with brisk, pragmatic intent.
"Jefe is smart enough to forbid you having weapons in the house."
Evan turned around, holding his arms wide. "He made that clear to me."
"Well, I'm making it clear, too. Open the back."
Evan unlocked the rear door and Darling Boy climbed up and in. He examined the interior carefully, his sunken eyes picking across every crack and fissure, his foot tapping beside the blackened disc of gum. Then he opened and studied the gear in every last Pelican case. Finally, he climbed through to the front and searched the seats, the glove box, the center console. He wormed back out to where Evan leaned against the side of the van, face tilted to the sun, soaking in some vitamin D.
"Find anything interesting?"
"Not yet,"
Darling Boy said, and headed into the mansion. Evan locked up the van and entered. The lean, jittery guard named Nacho greeted Evan in the foyer with a lowered MP7 and a hot glare.
"Jefe wants to see you," Nacho said, "in his bedroom."
Evan started back.
"You should know," Nacho called after him, "that you are hated here."
He had hungry, sullen features, gold-framed sunglasses pushed up into his glossy hair, hand loose at his belt, thumb tucked behind the grenade pouch, and those fucking teeth, like a mole rat's.
"You been whispering poison in Jefe's ear, making him paranoid about us. But he should not be paranoid about us. He should be paranoid about you."
"Ah," Evan said, "one of Darling Boy's men."
"Darling Boy has been with Jefe for 17 years. Darling Boy recruited most of us. We are all Darling Boy's men. And we will wait for you to stumble."
"Careful that you don't get hurt first," Evan said, "while you're waiting." He padded down the corridor, passing the first set of spiraling stairs and ascending the second. Montesco's suite was at the end of the corridor, double doors thrown wide, the sounds of vigorous sex issuing out. Evan stood in the doorway. A giant picture window overlooked the pool and cabana. The bed was enormous, two king-size mattresses set side by side, the furniture modern and overly sleek, lacquered woods and shiny chrome fittings. Montesco was entangled with five or so women, a confusing, squirming mass of limbs and flesh. Evan tried to do the math in his head and failed. A burly guard stood against the far wall, hand gripping opposite wrist by his waist, classic bodyguard position. His MP7 was slung, his eyes averted, expression impassive. Evan cleared his throat. Montesco's head popped up from the scrum. It took some effort for him to extricate himself, and then he shooed the women out. They gathered their clothes on the way, brushing past Evan. Their cheeks were flushed, but their manner was bored, businesslike, a construction crew leaving for lunch break. The guard didn't move. He might as well have been painted on the wall. Montesco came at Evan, glistening and naked, his left nostril powdered with white, tattooed lion gazing out from his inner arm.
Did you find the third shooter?
No, but I have a bead on him. My associate is still working to track him down. In the meantime, I want her to get back here to safe the estate.
I told you to bring me his head.
Montesco slid a flat hand beneath his nose, wiping the excess. The room smelled of sweat and sex.
I want him dead.
And he will be. I'm prioritizing your safety.
You have the gear you promised?
I do.
Has darling boy checked it all?
Proctologically. At this, the dark man cracked a smile.
You told me to trust no one. I am taking your advice seriously. I may like you, Caballo Oscuro, but you are still new to me. And my men? They are not taking to you.
It's not my job to be liked. It took some effort for Evan not to acknowledge Montesco's nakedness. It's my job to protect you, even against your own men, like Jovencito.
What do you need of me now?
I want to check the escape tunnels and hatches for hostile surveillance gear and explosives. Vehicles, too. I want to sweep them. Make sure that there are no tracking devices or explosives. Then I want to install additional security measures. Montesco nodded a few times rapidly, rooting in the heap of pillows on the floor and blessedly coming up with a bathrobe. Yanking open a drawer on the Hollywood Regency mirrored nightstand, he withdrew a lighter and a cracked cigarette.
Darling boy will oversee you.
Evan felt his body heat tick up a half degree. The first hitch in the plan he'd mentally rehearsed a few hundred times.
We don't like each other, Evan said, obviously.
It's close quarters work. I move fast, I move efficiently, and I move alone. Montesco swung his head around, freshly lit stick between his lips.
I don't give a fuck what you want. This is how it will go. Tomorrow morning you can start.
That too wide mouth stretched into an off-kilter smile.
Try and relax for once. Take a woman to your suite. Take two.
I'm good, Evan said. I want to interview the girl again, see if she remembers anything about Jovencito she didn't mention before. Maybe she saw something I didn't. Could help lead to the third shooter. Montesco held an inhale as he spoke, the words an airless screech.
You said you were closing in on the third shooter.
I'd like to close in quicker. Evan hesitated, for the first time unsure of his status here. Montesco's bloodshot eyes moved to his guard. The burly man returned the look, a flicker of shared suspicion. It's fine, Evan said. I'm tired anyway. I'm happy to deal with it when I get back to L.A.
No.
Montesco smiled, let the smoke leak through his teeth.
If you can squeeze more information out of her, do it.
As Evan withdrew, his sense of unease intensified. His absence had left room for darling boy to sow distrust, for paranoia to swell. He could only hope he had enough time before the wave broke.
He'd be watched every step of the way now, a feeling compounded by how the guards watched him as he headed to Angelina's room. Darling Boy sat in the chair outside her door, using his combat knife to shave the fingernail of his pinky into a point. He spoke without looking up. "She is sleeping." "Then I'll wake her," Evan said, barging in. Angelina shot up in the sheets with a yelp, startled by his entrance. "Shut up," he said loudly as the door swung closed behind him. "I have a few more questions for you." The door sealed, and he thumbed on his white noise app and eased to her side. "Listen to me carefully," he said quietly. "Do not leave this room for any reason until I come for you. Do not give anyone an excuse to get upset. Anything asked of you, obey. No complaining, no conflicts, no throwing off sparks. Tension is mounting, and until I can initiate extraction, I need you to stay as removed from Montesco's mind as possible." She crossed her arms atop the bulge of her belly. "What tension?" "I don't have time to explain. I just need you to listen. Understand?" "Okay, okay." She planted her feet on the mattress, pulled her thighs up against her belly. "Did you see my father?"
"Yes."
"What did he say?"
"He won't kill Raimundo."
"What else did he say?" "I don't have time to explain." "Did Mama talk to him?"
"Yes."
"Did he listen?"
"Yes."
There were tears in her eyes instantly. "Then everything will be okay." "I need to know that Raimundo won't get in the way of anything I need to do here." "What do you need to do?" The question surprised him. Despite what she had been through, what she had seen, she was still an innocent. "Kill everyone," he said. She blinked at him. "Why would you do that?" "Because it's the only way I can get you out. And it's the only way you won't be looking over your shoulder for the rest of your life. I'll ask you again. Will Montesco's son try to interfere?" She shook her head. "I don't think so." "Talk to him. Make sure. This is the last you'll see of me, before it's time." He started out. "Wait," she said in a whispered rush. He halted, picturing Darling Boy outside, that shared look between El Moreno and his guard in the bedroom. Evan's impatience intensified, a simmer in his stomach. "What?"
"My papa. I didn't want to disappoint him."
Evan said,
"I don't care." "The pressure of it," she said. "In his eyes, I was perfect. I tried to be for so long, and then I just couldn't."
He understood that she was terrified, but he couldn't bring himself to empathize with her.
"The more I did right, the more proud of me he was," she said, "and the more I could disappoint him."
"This is something that can be dealt with later."
"I know," she said in a diminutive voice that sounded much younger than her 18 years. "But I had to say it before I went home."
Her enormous brown eyes pulled to him.
"I needed someone to hear it."
"I heard it," Evan said. "Now stay in the room." Before going to sleep, Evan emerged from his bedroom and walked the mansion at night, guards watching him with glittering eyes, cologne and cigarette smoke wafting off them. The place was desolate, abandoned, just the armed men there in every room like staging props, as unnatural as the rest of the decor. He took a pass through the front yard, breathing the scent of night-blooming jasmine. The guards at the front gate kept him in view, shadowing him from afar. He gauged the distance from the front door to the van, from the van to the gates, from the gates to the limestone formations beyond, and he wondered if his planning had been sufficient. The margin for error was zero. He drifted close enough to the chicken coop to see someone's breath huffing out from between the cell bars. He moved closer. The captives were asleep, save for a young lady in her 20s with ratty hair and a pronounced nose. She hacked a few times, an unforgiving dry cough,
and then glared out at him with discerning eyes.
"You should be ashamed of yourself," she said in passable English. "You have a mother, sisters, a daughter maybe. You see us, but you pretend you don't. All those pretty girls come and go in the big house, and you keep us out here like cattle. Voiceless, faceless, nameless."
Behind her, her cellmates slumbered, buckets on the floor, filthy plates crusted with residue, slots in the bottoms of the doors sized for trays to be passed through, body odor and human waste, a barnyard reek. Evan stared at her through the bars. "What is your name?"
"Aurora," she said.
He dipped his head in acknowledgement.
"God is watching you," she said. "Everything you have done, everything you will do."
Evan thought, "I hope not," and walked back inside. The foyer guard rose as he passed. He drifted through the kitchen under the watchful eyes of two more men positioned at the bar in the adjoining conversation pit. The knives were missing from the wooden block, put away since Evan had left.
Interesting.
He walked past the antique steel safe, his 1911 and Strider knife held captive inside, along with a collection of other visitors' phones and weapons. Grabbing a bottled water from the refrigerator, he headed back through the ground floor. Behind him in the dark house, boots scuffed floorboards, doors opened and closed, the men tracking him as he made his quiet rounds under the guise of a nighttime stroll. A surfeit of lights illuminated the yard. Through the windows he confirmed guard positions, tallied the manpower, noted familiar gaits and postures and faces. His running count showed one sicario and 38 men, and nothing he saw now indicated an update was in order. The morning would hold a lot of killing. As he walked down a tight hallway, he spotted the rustic oak door of the study. It was ajar, its rounded top casting a skewed tombstone shadow across the tile floor. A bluish glow emanated through the threshold. Evan moved to the doorway and froze. A spa-like blue from the aquarium glass irradiated the dark walls and bookshelves, the rolling ladder and imposing mahogany desk. But none of the furnishings held Evan's attention. The figure floating inside the tank did. Slow-motion twists, like a synchronized swimmer who'd lost his partner. Bare-chested, tattered pants. Claw marks pronounced across the back of the torso from a leonine mauling. Half the head gnawed off. One leg missing at the knee. An arm ending in ribboned streamers of flesh. In the bisected jaw, a row of exposed molars glimmered like pearls. Hunks of flesh taken from the right flank, the left buttock, the meat of the thigh. Bubbles clung to what remained of the nose, the eyelashes, the spaces between the remaining toes.
Venustiano, the tree trimmer.
Evan sensed movement in his peripheral vision. Way down at the ends of the hall, figures moved into view, faces barely lit. Darling Boy to the left, Nacho to the right. Darling Boy smiled at him. Even from this distance, his teeth looked like stumps inserted at random into his caving gums.
"We figured this mono needed to be taught a lesson more than Romeo did. I convinced Jefe not to wait till the end of the month."
Evan shrugged.
"You don't have patience for the long-term plan."
"What long-term plan is that?"
Evan looked back at the corpse, spinning slowly in the ethereal light, sea-changed and gruesomely bewitching with pallid skin and purpled viscera. Faint whiff of chlorine and formaldehyde. The study itself was like a theater set. All those unread books, the empty blotter, the disused Mont Blanc.
To men like El Moreno and Darling Boy, little in this world was authentic. Other humans weren't real. Their suffering wasn't real. The families they left behind weren't real.
Evan pulled back, walking toward Nacho, but turned right down the next corridor,
leaving the men momentarily behind. A dark stone corridor, thick with the scent of animal musk. He heard it then. A low, ticking growl. No, not a growl. A contented snore. Floor-to-ceiling bars set in the stone near the end, light falling through, broken into slats. He neared. Sure enough, the king slumbered, lying on his side, spine pressed to the cold rock of the rear wall, muzzle stained from the day's feast, massive paws like spiked boxing gloves, twitching with a remembered pursuit. Evan put his shoulder blades to the wall opposite and slid down to sit on the floor. The lion hoisted his massive head and regarded him, orange-brown eyes burning bright. He curled his top lip and tasted the air, tasted Evan's scent, the ridiculous brown pom-pom at the end of his tail shushing across the floor. The tuft was used for balance and to lead other lions through the long grass. Spined tongue sharp enough to slough the skin off your hand with a few licks. Incisors spaced to slide between the vertebrae of prey and sever the spine surgically. Everything by design, cruel and majestic. The lion didn't care about lost daughters and damaged sons. Didn't know how to engage in small talk or what to bring to a dinner party. Didn't understand how to talk to a frustrated 16-year-old hacker, a woman on the verge of a life-ending surgery, a 9-year-old boy terrified of being left motherless. He was built for one thing and one thing only. They shared the air for a time. The mansion was so quiet it could almost be mistaken for peaceful. Finally, Evan rose, one knee cracking. The lion's head lifted to track his movement. They regarded each other through the bars with something approaching professional courtesy. Evan gave him a nod. "You and me, pal," he said, and headed out. Chapter 52. Scared of him all the way down. Evan was awakened by screaming, tumbling out of bed already dressed, banging into the stupid floor vase as he yanked on his boots, laces untied, stumbling to the door. El Moreno bellowing somewhere in the mansion, and then the sound of a gunshot, amplified inside interior walls. Evan sprinted down the hall toward the commotion, heart pounding. The guards were standing by the chairs, heads cocked like dogs alerting to a threat. As Evan passed them, they sprang into action, following his lead. Evan was weaponless, running into the unknown. Another gunshot. Montesco was juiced up on crack and cocaine. Had he just ended the mission with a bullet to Angelina's head? Evan flew down the floating spiral stairs, clearing the final twist to see that it wasn't Angelina at the end of the gun. It was Raimundo. On his knees in the sunken conversation pit by the bar, cheeks smashed in the grip of his father's hand, Montesco placed the gun parallel to his son's temple. "Tell me." "Papa, I swear." Bang. Raimundo fell over, clutching his ear. Another hole opened up on the couch cushion behind him, tufted white foam appearing next to the other ruptures, a trio of eyeballs. Darling Boy stood down in the pit with them, the heel of his hand resting on the pommel of his sheathed knife. A few other guards rimmed the top of the space, looking on awkwardly, other men running toward the sound of gunfire, pouring into the mansion from all directions. "What the fuck is this?" Now El Moreno was shaking something in his son's face. "What do you need an untraceable phone for?"
"It was to call Angelina. Before you knew about us, I swear..."
"Why did Darling Boy find this beneath your mattress now? Why?"
"I forgot about it. I..."
"Did you set me up in San Bernardino?" Montesco shouted, saliva flying from his lips. "Were you working with Jovencito? Did you know who the shooters were?" The gun now in his son's mouth.
"No, no, no, no."
Barrel to the temple. "What are these fucking numbers? Why were you calling America?"
"I was calling..."
Bang. This shot, close enough to nick the edge of Raimundo's ear. He clamped a hand over the side of his head, trickles of blood forking around his index finger.
"We are searching for traitors under my roof, and we find this? From you? I don't care if you're my blood. I will kill you. Understand? I will end you."
The situation was redlining, and Evan's position fraught, his cover one false move from being blown. And he had to do something fast before Raimundo's gray matter wound up spattered all over the couches. Evan stepped down into the conversation pit and opened his mouth to speak, when a voice from behind him shouted, "Stop!" He could not bring himself to believe it. Not even when he turned and saw her racing down the spiral staircase, bare feet fluttering, Nacho tearing along the catwalk above in pursuit. Angelina clutched her stomach with one hand, her hair swept back, cheeks aflame. In her stubbornness and outrage, Evan saw an echo of her father, the fervor that would get her killed. The one order he'd given her. After everything he'd put on hold and put at risk, after all the blood and sweat the past 2 weeks had brought, after the meticulous planning, risks taken, injuries accrued, dangers outstanding, she'd had one task and one task only. Stay in her room until he could save her. And despite everything at stake, she'd been unable to listen. At the worst possible time, she'd barreled into the powder keg, sparks flying. His anger strained toward the breaking point, found alignment with his cover, true emotion undergirding his fictitious role. A lifetime spent holding back that fury, channeling it into calm action. But now, he felt it bucking at the reins, his grip starting to slip. She reached the bottom of the stairs, Nacho at her heels. Guards were already moving to intercept her when Evan blew his top. He arrowed at her, leading with a diamond tip of cold rage. "God damn it, girl!" She stopped flat-footed, recoiling from the sight of him, confused terror flashing in her eyes. She was scared of him all the way down. She had every reason to be. "I told you to stay in your fucking room!" He drew back his hand to strike her. Beneath his boiling temper, he sensed the terrible alignment of interests, felt the dark streak within himself that was thinner, but no less deep than Aragon's or El Moreno's, the fathomless malevolence no one on the planet was above or beyond. "Wait!" Evan stopped his hand back by his ear, freezing the wind-up. El Moreno walked over to him, his expression resembling surprise. Evan's overreaction had jarred Montesco out of his own frenzy.
"Calm down, Caballo Oscuro. Calm down."
Evan felt the spell break, felt the rage he'd summoned drain out of him. The ploy had worked. He lowered his hand to his side. Montesco moved to him.
"Funny, I know. Me telling you to calm down. But you can't hurt this vaca. She holds my future here."
Montesco peeled up Angelina's shirt, trembling. She let him. He placed his hand on her bare stomach. Her face was contorted with disgust, anger yielding to shame. So many guards in the room, all of them looking on, spellbound. Nothing she could do but allow him to touch this most intimate part of her.
"Since my son is a traitorous culero,"
Montesco said, rubbing her skin,
"the boy in her belly is all I have left."
"Let me see the phone." Evan held out his hand. Montesco looked at Darling Boy, then placed the throwaway in Evan's hand. Evan thumbed up the call history, several dozen listings.
"These are all to one number," Evan said. "With an American area code,"
Darling Boy said. Evan thumbed redial. A 2-second delay, followed shortly by a spectral ringing in the room, the sound echoing metallically. The guards looked up, around, at one another.
Evan stared at the rusting old-fashioned safe. Montesco's jaw clenched. He walked over, spun the dial, removed an iPhone in a pink rubber case with Angelina spelled out on the back in gold-studded stickers. The phone rang once more and then made a woeful dying noise as it lost charge. Darling Boy lowered his eyes, hands limp at his sides. Humiliated before his beloved overlord and the others, the full manpower of the estate had been drawn inside, all 38 men. A tactical disaster begotten by narcissism. Montesco demanded the attention of everyone around him every waking minute. His mood set the tempo of the entire estate. All eyes had been on him as he'd fumed and bellowed and fired his weapon into the couch cushions. He'd been too coddled too long to learn one of the key lessons imparted to Evan.